and Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr, and welcome to my show tonight. Thanks for taking the time to be with us. Tonight I have with us Stephen Buhner, and we're going to talk about many things, but specifically we were going to originally focus on his book, The Secret Teachings of Plants, and he's written many books, but I've had this book sitting in my bookshelf for years. His publicist sent it to me literally years ago, and I don't know why I didn't do it. I interviewed him on his other books, and I don't know why this one's up there. Well, I do now. Because when I opened up this book, The Secret Teachings of Plants, it was really about heart and heart health and heart emotions and coherence and love. And I had a massive heart attack in September. And so when I opened this and saw it, I went, oh, my God, what a huge synchronicity. No wonder. It's attracted me so, but I just never made it happen till now. So welcome, Stephen. Thank you for taking the time to come on my show. And I don't know if you realize, but to me, it's a gigantic synchronicity. And when we get off the show tonight, I want to call you and tell you something else. And it just kind of blows me away. So before
well,
we get
thanks
started,
for having me on, Eva. I can tell from having a heart attack, it would be a lot of synchronicity in that.
Yeah. And there's something else, too. I mean, I just talked to Rowan McCrady yesterday about doing something. And I want to talk to you. I'll talk to you about when we get off the air. But it kind of literally flipped me out when I opened this book because it was not what I was expecting. So tell us before we get started, you know, about you and where people can find you. And you have many, many books that really should be a staple on anybody's bookshelf. If they're interested in bacteria, you know, antibiotic-resistant bacteria and doing treating illnesses holistically, you run the gamut. So just tell us a little bit about
it. Well, I'm working on my 20th book now, so there's been quite a few that have come along, and I've just been interested in mostly the wildness of the world, really, in natural ecosystems. And so I write about that a lot, which is The Secret Teachings of Plants is part of a series I've been working on for a while. And then I also do more specific work on natural medicine. And I guess I just had an incredibly expanded version of my herbal antibiotics book released not too long ago. So those are sort of my two major areas of focus. And if people want to find me, they can always find me at my website, which is GaianStudies.org, G-A-I-A-N, studies.org.
Well, that's actually one of the books that I was talking about. It needs to be a staple on everybody's bookshelf. Now, I don't remember when it was that I interviewed you about that, but it was really a most wonderful interview. So if anybody's interested, please email me at evaher@gmail.com, and I'll go find the date and post it on my Facebook or something, because it was something worth listening to. I remember I said to Stephen, you know, he talks about, he knows everything when it comes to plants. So I said, if you know, we can't have those hundreds of plants in our medicine cabinets, but if we had to have, you know, a starter kit, what would it be? And he gave me a list, I don't know, of 10 or 12, and it's in that interview. So if you want to go back and find that, it's worth your time. So let's talk about this book, Stephen. I mean, I was expecting to find research about, and I'm sure there's some in here, but I got stuck on those heart chapters, about the secret teachings of plants. First of all, what do they teach us? And I'm going to ask you two questions so I don't forget. Secondly, you talk about consciousness in this book, and that's something that you and I have never talked about, but it's a passion of mine. In fact, I just published a book called Consciousness, Bridging the Gap Between Conventional Science and the New Science of Quantum Mechanics. So I didn't realize that you had such an interest in that. So what is your definition of consciousness, just so we make sure we're on the same page?
Well, it's fairly expansive. I mean, I'm working on a new book now that I have to turn in early May called Gaia's Mind. And one of the things that I'm looking at in that is intelligence in, you know, the ecosystem, or basically general intelligence in this place, you know, that we live. And see, it turns out that everything that any kind of self-organized biological system, and The Secret Teachings of Plants is really the first book where I started looking specifically at self-organization. But there's this, you know, everybody knows about gravity. If you drop something, it falls and things like that. But there's another thing that happens in living systems that is much more interesting, that scientists really, they don't know why it happens. It just seems to be sort of a rule of this place, and that is that if you get, for instance, pack a jar, a closed container full of molecules, there'll be this point that nobody can predict where they all couple together tightly as one self-organized whole, and they start moving and acting as one unit, and that's known as self-organization. Well, it turns out every living organism, every living system that we run into is self-organized in just that way, and every organ in our body is like that. And the thing is, anytime there's a self-organized system, the system becomes highly intelligent. So I'm doing some deeper work in this new book talking about bacteria, and it turns out that bacteria build cities very much like ours, only they're very tiny, of course. They're called biofilms. They have highways in the cities. They have communication networks. They have a really highly developed language. They have a culture. They pass on knowledge from generation one generation to the next. And you begin to find that pretty much everywhere you go, this incredible intelligence. So what happens when something self-organizes? There's really something more than the sum of the parts that comes into being. And that thing is highly aware of anything that touches it from the outside, which is why bacteria are so good at creating resistance to pharmaceuticals. As soon as they encounter one, they start figuring out solutions to it, and they literally experiment just the way we do, and they teach other people about it, other bacteria about it. So, I mean, one of the things I found out is slime molds can actually find their way through a maze faster than a graduate student, you know, going through a similar but much larger maze. So the thing is, there's this degree of intelligence everywhere, and for organisms to be able to, when they're touched by something from outside, they actually have to figure out what it is, if its intent is, you know, malevolent or, you know, beneficial, and then they have to figure out a response, and they generate responses across a wide range, and nobody can predict that, which is sort of the essence of nonlinearity or chaos theory. So to me, what consciousness is, it's a thing that happens whenever there's a self-organized system. And in every one of those systems, there's actually a neural network that forms that's able to perceive in ways not that much different than us. And that's really, to me, what it is. So I've been looking at that for a long time, for over 40 years now, and looking at the way different organisms and different cultures of people work with that. So when you get to The Secret Teachings of Plants, that's continuing a theme that I've been interested in for a long time, which is native peoples, tribal peoples around the world, they didn't find the uses of their plant medicines through scientific study. And when they were asked about it, and I have a lot of firsthand accounts, several hundred of them actually, from several centuries ago, they were really clear they didn't learn the use of their plant medicines through trial and error. They learned of it through, they would say, the plant told me, or it came to me in a dream or a vision or something like that. And so that's what this book is looking at. And I first looked at it in depth in 1996 in a book called Sacred Plant Medicine, and in this one, I'm looking at people in the Western world who came to the same conclusion and talk about exactly how they did that. So that's sort of a semi-short answer to your question.
It's very interesting. I could sit and listen to it for the rest of the night. Let's start with your chapter. It's actually chapter 4, and I'm going to give you time before the end of the show to talk about anything that you think is important that I missed or skipped over for whatever reason. So don't, or if you think we should talk about something before I ask this on chapter 4, just let me know, okay?
But sure. One of Remind me what chapter 4 is.
The physical heart, the heart as an organ of the body.
Okay.
And
what do you want to talk about that?
Generally people think that the heart is a pump. And you talk about in here how it's really not necessarily a pump at all. And I found that very interesting and very important. You talk about how it's sends out hormones and neurohormonal, electric, magnetic, and chemical messages. And I'd just like for you to talk about that some and educate us about it. Because since I had that heart attack, I'm like desperate to learn everything I can about the heart and why what happened. And
well,
I'm sharing it with everybody
people
on the radio. I'm letting them follow my path. So I want to educate the world that they have hope and they don't have to have veins jerked out of their legs or, you know, pig valves put in their heart. And I want to give them hope.
Well, we've been raised, and the United States has been immersed for about a century in a mechanical view of the world. And the sort of the picture that's been built up of our bodies and pretty much all other living systems started being developed in mostly the late 1800s, as industrialization was starting to become this paramount thing. And people were looking at the world then. They used mechanical metaphors for everything because that's what was new then. It's like it's common now to hear stuff like people use the internet and various aspects of the internet as metaphors for things. But back then, everybody was using steam engine terminology and things like that. So the entire body began to be looked at as a mechanical organ, like a car or a train or something like that. And all of the organs were defined that way. The thing is, people have known, scientists that are any good anyway, and that's actually quite a number of them, have known for a long time, since the 1920s, that picture wasn't very accurate. Nevertheless, it kept being used. And so we've, you know, learned to think of just our organs still that way as replaceable parts, and people get heart transplants and things like that. The thing is, the heart isn't really just a pump, mechanical pump. It does a huge number of things. And, you know, one of the major things that I look at in the book is that the heart's really an electromagnetic generator. When it beats, it's creating an electromagnetic field that extends past the surface of the body. It's 5,000 times stronger than the one that the brain creates. And everybody knows this in their experience. They just don't think about it because we're taught something entirely different. But you can really tell if you walk up too close to somebody and you're in their space and there's that discomfort of being too close. What's happening at that moment, you're standing inside the electromagnetic field that their heart generates. And people at the HeartMath Institute, they've done a lot of great research, and there's other people that have as well, and I drew on a lot of their really leading-edge work for this book, as well as my own experiences and looking at what people in other cultures had said about it over the centuries. But, you know, they've shown that, you know, scientific instruments, the most sensitive ones, can measure that field up to 10 feet from the body, and it actually extends further than that. The instruments just aren't sensitive enough to pick it up. And heart fields tend to synchronize. Like, our hearts, when you're walking down the street with somebody, your heart will tend to, or you'll want to start walking in rhythm with them, in synchronicity with them. And that's part of the way our heart field, it's an example of how multiple hearts tend to synchronize with each other. Musicians, when they're in the groove and they're all playing together, they're doing that as well. But what I talk about in the book is how that because we're trained to be in our head so much, to mentally think, to have our brain be the dominant location of our consciousness, that what happens is that field isn't strong enough for the whole body to synchronize to it. So you start to get what's called in nonlinear theory or chaos theory, multiple attractors in the body. So the body becomes somewhat disorganized. And some of the neat stuff that people have done, there's a guy named, I think is Ari Goldberger in Denver, who's been doing some great, he's a cardiac physician, he's been doing some great research, and he's shown that if you get people to start to work with their heart field directly, where they actually move their consciousness from their brain into their heart, and they start living from their heart or feeling from their heart that way, the heart function starts to normalize, even if they have fairly severe heart diseases. So it's not a surprise that of all of the countries on Earth, the United States has more heart disease than any other country. And really a lot of it is because physiologically, when as soon as you shift thinking or your seat of consciousness, and one of the points that I make from a lot of studies and just personal experiences, consciousness can actually locate to any part of the body that you want it to locate to. And, you know, indigenous cultures, they would say that their seat of consciousness was in their chest area of the heart. Here, if you ask somebody, they're going to point to their head. And that's a cultural learning. It's not fundamental. People that have done psychological studies of cultures all around the world have found that most of them are being judged by an American psychological framework, which really doesn't fit because most cultures don't live from the same place that we do. So in any event, just shifting your awareness from your brain into your heart, heart function will begin to normalize. And Ari Goldberger develops some really great exercises to help people do that. He can lower blood pressure 20 points just by doing that, and I've worked with that a long time and seen it myself. So if you begin to get rid of the idea of the heart as a mechanical organ and realize it's a living, self-organized system that's highly responsive to its environment, you start to get a much better picture of the world. You know, just as an example, people have looked at bacteria for a long time as just these sort of mechanical things, and the truth is, they're highly responsive to the world as well, and that's one of the reasons why they develop. If you understand they're highly intelligent and highly responsive and highly innovative, and that they're 3.5 billion years old, and the human species is at most 2 million years old, but more likely the way we are, about 35,000 years, they've been at this a lot longer. They're highly adaptable. So you have to understand the world really isn't what we've taught it to be. It's something else entirely.
So what do you attribute heart attacks to?
Well, there's a lot of different things that can cause that. I mean, one of the things that happens with people when they're thinking a lot in their head and worrying about stuff, that actually shifts the hormone production in the body considerably. The adrenal glands start producing more adrenaline and more cortisol, and so at that point the blood vessels begin to narrow considerably. The eyes become more pinpoint focused. It's a particular thing that's supposed to happen at moments where you need that kind of facility, and it actually facilitates mental acuity. But when you do that as a habit of mind over a very long period of time, what you start to get is high blood pressure, and it has a lot of negative impacts on heart function. You know, there's a lot of people focus on food and things like that, but when you really look at it, there's a lot of cultures that eat, you know, if you're looking at healthy food, if you're in that metaphor, they eat much worse than we do, but yet they remain more healthy heart-wise. So it's not that exclusively, though it does play some role. And another thing that I've seen, I trained and worked as a psychotherapist for many years, and the other thing is people in America are literally the most fearful culture I've ever had exposure to. They're less trusting of any other people. It's very hard for them to get physical touch or to ask for help when they need it. If, you know, in other countries, if somebody's ill, they take a long time to recuperate before they go back to work. Here, we go back right away. So there's this lack of self-nurturing that causes people to be in a much more high alert sort of state. And that has a lot of negative attributes on heart function. I mean, you can actually see when a mother holds their child and the child just relaxes into the mother, their whole physiology shifts. They relax, their heart beats slower, their blood vessels actually dilate so that the blood flows through, and they shift into this kind of place where they take in a kind of nurturing that really does affect physiological functioning. So, and probably the third thing I would have to add is the medicine that we use in the United States, pharmaceuticals are fairly toxic, and although they have a place and they're often very important, we use more of them than anybody else in the world. I'm 61, and I don't take any pharmaceuticals at all. I mean, very, very rarely for dental work or something like that. Almost everybody I know that's my age is taking at least one pharmaceutical every day, if not two or three. And I have several friends who live in Kansas, for instance, who are taking 12 or 13 pharmaceuticals every day, and they're my same age. Those things have an effect on the health of the body over time, and that's not particularly good. So those are sort of the three things that I've found to be the major dynamics involved.
Well, before we go forward, I thought of something I need to do. I want to do a disclaimer. You are not a medical doctor. I'm not a medical doctor. And we are not trying to treat or diagnose anyone. Everything that we're saying on this show tonight is for informational purposes only. If you have any questions or you want to know, you know, if you have some problems yourself, you need to go and see your personal health care provider. Just want to make sure that we say that.
Yeah, I pretty much think of myself as a social irritant, not a physician.
Yeah, I think of myself as a humanitarian kind of thing and a connector. But that sounds exactly what happened to me. I mean, it sounds exactly like you peeked into my mind and you know exactly how I think. I've decided that I'm going to go on a totally holistic route. So that's what I'm doing. So I'm either going to be dead in a few months or I'm going to be really well, according to the protocol that I've picked and what the people are saying about it. But one thing that I wanted to ask you about is one of the doctors said that people don't really have heart attacks because they have clogged arteries, because collaterals are formed. They really have heart attacks, especially those Widowmaker heart attacks, because they get acidosis in that ventricle. And so a lot of people suggested this West African herb, G. strumpfantum. Hope I said that right. Are you familiar with that?
I'm not familiar with that pronunciation.
Old Bane in the United States.
And see, I'm terrible with pronunciation anyway because I read massively. So, you know, I know lots and lots of words visually, and sometimes I embarrass myself when I talk because I've never actually heard anybody say a lot of them. So,
yeah.
But I don't recognize that from your pronunciation, no.
Okay. Well, the United States word is Obain, O-U-B-A-I-N. Does that ring a bell?
I don't know that.
Okay. So could we talk about... you talk also in your book about potassium and sodium getting out of balance. I have that problem. And nobody seems to understand, you know, why that problem really happens. Because I eat a healthy diet, and I'm active, and I drink a lot of water, and I don't eat corn, and I try to eat organic. So can you talk about that at all? But the doctors...
Diet is really different than everybody else's, pretty much. And, you know, the closest person who thinks of food the way I do is Jeanine Roth, who wrote a marvelous book called When Food is Love. And she was horribly overweight and had tried zillions of diets. And then she just thought, to heck with it. She goes, what I'm going to do is I'm going to eat whatever I want and let my body figure out what it needs. And all of her friends were like, oh, no, that's horrible, horrible. And, of course, at first she gained a bunch more weight. But as she kept doing it, she started losing. She was eating whatever she wanted, but she began to lose weight. And she lost all the weight that she had. She's not fat anymore, okay? And the thing is, there's been some interesting studies about that where they took some children, and they took like 30 children, and they were all pretty much identical in terms of their family and their socioeconomic status and everything. And in one group that they followed, the parents were getting them to eat a healthy diet every day, three meals a day. And the other group, the parents let them eat whatever they wanted, whenever they wanted it, without exception. Okay, the first group that did all the healthy eating, they ended up with a lot of eating disorders later in life, and the first group had none. Okay, so what basically happened in the group where they ate whatever they wanted, the children learned to trust their own body to tell them what they wanted to have, what it wanted to have, what it needed. And in our culture right now, nobody trusts the human body. We basically look at it as this thing we have to drag around behind us that's our enemy, that gets sick or makes us sick or things like that. And we have lost the trust in our body. And Goethe, the German poet and botanist who I talk about a lot in this book, said, it makes a marvelous difference whether you find in the body an ally or an adversary. So I was raised pretty much like everybody and was really dissociated from my body. And so I, in my 20s, began to do exactly that same thing Jeanine Roth had done. And it took me a long time to work it through. But the thing I found, and I raised my son that way as well, and he's very healthy, and he, you know, he eats whatever he wants, but he learned after a while to follow what it was that he needed. So, for instance, sometimes I will get really hungry for bananas, and I'll eat a lot of bananas. Now, bananas have a lot of potassium in it, and I know from that it's my body craving the things that the banana has in it. And so people, if they have exposure to a wide range of food and they can rekindle that trust in their body, they end up finding the foods that they need to eat. Now, one of the things that I mentioned in The Secret Teachings of Plants, but I didn't do a whole lot with, was that the human body has three primary large biological oscillators, each with very extensive neural networks. One is the brain, one is the heart, and the third one is the GI tract. Now, I was curious for a long time why the GI tract had such an extensive neural network, because it's massive. And then over the years, as I studied and worked with it more, I began to understand that because the GI tract also has an electromagnetic field that it generates that's fairly large, much actually larger than the brain's as well. And what happens is that electromagnetic field, when it touches food, actually has the capacity to analyze what's in the food and determine whether or not it's toxic to the body or whether the body needs it. And it has two mechanisms for doing this. One, it doesn't actually have to ingest anything. And then the second one, it has to ingest it, and then it sort of creates a memory of that thing. And that's one of the reasons babies crawl around and put so many things in their mouth when they're first exploring the world. It's giving that part of the body, it starts to create a database of knowledge about that. Now, there's been some fascinating studies people have done, for instance, with bees, where when bees approach nectar, they've actually been able to measure the field that their particular GI tract is putting out and to see that the bees can actually analyze whether a nectar is toxic to it or not through using that mechanism. So there's definitely a physiological basis for this, and of course it makes sense for living organisms to have that capacity over the millions of years, billions of years of evolution that have happened on this planet, as organisms get sophisticated about the food that they have to take in, there's sort of fail-safe dynamics. But because we're trained out of trusting our bodies, and because we don't have much access to wild foods anymore, most of the food that's actually produced, it's hard for me to actually think of it as food, but people just eat what's there. They aren't really used to analyzing it. And I think that's the thing. Every human ecology is very different. Every human body is a different ecosystem. Everybody needs slightly different groupings of food at different times and different ways. And so the only person that knows that best is that person. So you can't really create a top-down thing. I trained for quite a while in cancer treatment, and many, many years ago with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and Stephanie Simonton and some other people. And Stephanie and Carl Simonton were the people that created guided imagery for healing, and they were using it with their cancer patients. And Stephanie Simonton said at one time, she goes, look, you can't, diet does have some place in health, but you can't rely on it. She said, I've seen terminal cancer patients get well eating only Big Macs every day. And I've seen them die on the healthiest diet you could imagine. And I've seen them get well on healthy diets and die on Big Macs. So it's not that. It's whatever their unique system needs. And so that's something I've paid attention to. And I really encourage people to learn how to restore that trust in their body, because their body knows what they need to take to be healthy more than anything else. I mean, that's its job, really.
I'm going to ask a question, but I don't want to spend a long time on it. I just want to ask the question, okay?
All right.
When you talk about food, I live up in a rural area in the Appalachians, but really it could apply anywhere. But it really applies here, because these people, what I've realized is many of them have no idea even how to prepare food. They don't know how to go to the store and say, oh, I want to have a tomato on Friday, and today's Wednesday. How do I choose a tomato that won't be too ripe then? Or if that makes any sense. And two, they think that, I guess, I mean, I'm inserting an opinion here, but they think that they've started getting successful when they don't have to stand in front of the stove for hours every night, that they can go to the aisle with Hamburger Helper or go back by McDonald's. So all the kids are overweight with diabetes and insulin resistance. So are you talking about letting them do that?
Well, that's not exactly what they're doing in that instance. They're not trusting their body in that sense, because what they're doing is responding to actually commercials more than anything else. It takes, for a lot of people, and you're kind of experiencing this now, it seems from what you've said, and I went through that myself. There's nothing like a good chronic illness to get the, I mean, it's really what gets people to start to wake up and become aware. And it takes that kind of awareness. You have to have a reason that you want to start thinking about that. Either you have to be trusted when you're young to figure it out and sort of educated and trained by your parents, or else later in life when you realize the life you're living doesn't work, you have to start to do something else. And that's been my path, because my parents certainly weren't very, very aware. They were highly dysfunctional. And it just takes a long journey like that. It really does. There has to be a predicating factor where you go, wait a second, I need to change these things.
Another thing you talk about in your in section two of the physical heart is that that there are vortexes in the blood flow. I don't know how to say it right.
There are. I mean, you know, everybody's probably seen that thing where if you have a bottle full of water and you want to pour it out, and so you shake it up and down and it takes a certain amount of time, but if you swirl the bottle around in a circle and create kind of like a you know, a twister, and it twists like that, it'll go out like it's going down a bathroom, a bathtub drain. It goes a lot faster. Well, nature's very, very efficient. So our blood vessels, our blood as it travels through the blood vessels actually travels in a vortex like that, very much like a tornado. And there's a, in the center of the bloodstream, it's a vacuum, really. And so the blood vessels actually twist to facilitate that movement of the blood through the body. It's just a lot more efficient of a mechanism. So that's what I was talking about there.
Do you have recommendations for anything that I should do? Because I'm doing the PK protocol, which is phosphatidylcholine and amino acids, and you know, lots of
right. A lot of that stuff's really good, and I've got some really great protocols for heart disease. And if you email me, I'll just send them to you.
I'd love to have it because I'm really trying to be loud and vocal about it, and I'm really being rigid about sticking to the protocol so that we'll know if it really works.
Right.
And that way,
well, there's a lot of really good things out there that can help, and I would be glad to send you a protocol.
Thank you.
Just email.
Very much.
Sure.
Okay, so how do you you talk about lactic acid, and you're talking in the hormone, the heart as an endocrine gland. And you're talking about hormones produced by the heart, ANP and ANF, and I found that very interesting. And so I wanted to know, how do you prevent, you talk about lactic acid, so how do you prevent the buildup of lactic acid in the body? And what is the importance of that?
Well, a lot of that dynamic for me. So let's look at it another way, because that, you know, I mean, that approach is a little more mechanical than the way I like to get at it. So in general, when you're talking about the heart as an endocrine gland and that it literally produces hormones and different chemical substances in response to what it's experiencing. So you have to understand that even if you're not consciously aware of it, whenever you go any place, there's a feeling to that place. You know, everybody's had the experience of they walk into a restaurant they think they're going to like, and they look at each other and go, this place feels kind of weird, let's leave. That's what I'm talking about here. And the heart is always touching the exterior world like that. It's just we don't pay attention to it. But whenever it touches the world like that, what happens is, based on its analysis, it creates different hormones and neurochemicals that it then sends to the brain, and the brain then, because it creates a kind of a neural communication with the brain to let it know what kind of environment that it's in. So one of the primary things I do to change the chemical dynamics that are happening in the heart, and that's why the heart math stuff is so interesting in Ari Goldberger's work, because they're showing that you don't really have to, in many instances, ingest a whole lot of different chemicals or look at it just mechanically. If you get into this other dynamic, the heart will start shifting itself, you know, because it knows what to do. So one of the major things that I do is suggest that people do some exercises, which I have in the book, which will actually change heart function, and that'll actually start the production of more healthy neurochemicals and chemical releases in the heart, so the heart automatically starts becoming healthier. And another thing is, you know, and it's going to sound a little bit trite because everybody's heard it before, but to put yourself in situations that feel good, that feel nurturing to the self as much as you possibly can, so that you begin getting a sense of, this one musician I know, she calls it love chicken. She says you got to have a lot of love chicken in your life if you want to be happy and healthy. And so you kind of start looking for love chicken wherever you go, and you start spending more time with that and less in places that just don't feel quite right, or they feel a little dissociated or whatever. So you can do that. You can, you know, and then the protocol that I talked about, I'll send you, that'll help as well. But it's really learning how to nurture the self so that the heart literally does feel happy, that you feel happy and nurtured, and just like when you were 4 years old.
You know, one of the things that you talk about in this book is to get connected to plants, to talk that your, if I understand this correctly, that your body, your consciousness can communicate with their consciousness. And an interesting thing, when I had this heart attack, we built on a couple of, we built a new office zone for me to our house. And so about a month ago, because I had it in September when I got feeling well enough that I could get up and go out, I went to Home Depot and I bought daylight lighting and filled my entire office with tropical plants. And it feels so much better to me to have, it smells like dirt when I come in here.
Uh-huh.
And it feels good. So if you could talk a little about why people need to do connect with plants or hug a tree or pick out a plant that feels good to them, why is that important?
Human beings, look, all of the life forms on this planet emerged out of the ecological matrix of this planet. And we're made up of billions of years of innovation on bacterial and other life forms. And our body is made to be in natural ecosystems, in natural systems. We're used to being around other life forms all the time. And as I said earlier, our hearts really do pick up the fields of other life forms. When we're walking through a forest, we're literally, part of the reason people feel good in a forest is they're feeling the heart fields, if you will, that are given off by the trees and the plants and everything else. And there's a kind of a touching that occurs in that, that human beings need to be healthy. You can get it, even if you live in a big city like New York City or something like that, just by simply going to the park or having plants in your house. And I remember being in England, in London, which is a massive mega city as well, and a lot of the people, I was walking along many of the different streets because I love to do that in a new city, and there were a lot of people coughing with these lung conditions and stuff. And what was fascinating to me is all along the walkways there were these old walls, and growing out of the walls and in the cracks of the sidewalks and in the yards were actually plants that are specific for lung problems. I mean, hundreds of them. But they walked by all completely oblivious to this dynamic. And the thing is, there's something in the relationship between human beings and plants that's extremely old. I mean, in a number of the indigenous cultures, they would say that human beings are the offspring of the plants. They are our family, and that's why they care so much for us. But if you look at even a Western science explanation, the plants created the atmosphere which allowed the emergence of our species. We literally are their offspring. So there's this very deep bond in our genome where when we're around plants, it helps us to begin to feel better. And a lot of people have that experience. And what's more, the plants give off, they have a certain intelligence and caring that they give off. They're literally the most caring of most of the wild organisms people will ever encounter, plus just simply the respiration that they take in carbon dioxide and breathe out oxygen. It makes the room just feel better just from that simple place. But it's really part of our ancient heritage to have that relationship, and I think there's something deep in the body that causes people to feel better. Their body remembers the way it's supposed to be. Anyway, I've seen that a lot over the last 40 years and too many times to ignore it.
I want to ask one more question, and you're going to think you've already asked me that question, but I'm going to ask it a different way, and then I'm going to give you the rest of the show to talk about what you want to talk about. I'm going to read this sentence. ANF is depleted in hypertension, and impairment of the ability of the heart to produce ANF is directly correlated to the progress of hypertension. I just know that's me.
Uh-huh.
How do I fix that? I just know it's me. How do you fix that?
The easiest way to fix it is basically changing adrenal function, in my opinion.
I mean, just
so that your adrenal glands begin producing less adrenaline and less cortisol, and they begin producing other substances which help the blood vessels to relax and get healthy. I mean, there's a number of things that can help. I mean, if you just even want to look at diet and stuff like that, hawthorn berries, which are in the rose family, for instance, are extremely good at helping correct that. And part of the problem is that we don't have enough wild foods on our diet. I eat a lot of food range that's not normal for most people, and I take a lot of herbs just every time I feel my body getting out of whack to help replace that. But the major shift is really shifting out of a stress-induced dynamic and moving into a more nurturing, relaxed dynamic. And, you know, that's why I talk in the book about a lot of specific ways to do that, and also point people to other groups that are doing that kind of work as well, so that they have multiple metaphors and approaches for how to do that. But that simple thing, see, at this point, I can tell now if my blood pressure is starting to go up because of vasoconstriction and damage, and I immediately then begin to shift it. It's a problem anybody that overworks has after a while. And that's really the major way to shift it, and it really does make a difference. And also, and I can say another thing, and I talk about this a lot in my fasting book, that, you know, doing deep fasting also will correct a lot of heart function and a lot of problems.
What do you mean deep fasting? Tell me about that. Tell us about that.
Well, it's basically, you know, working with juice fast to begin with, but if you really do have severe coronary disease, water fasting over an extended period of time will actually correct a lot of that in the circulatory system. I mean, it's the studies on it are really good. The results are really good. And it's one of the best ways to correct poor heart function.
Okay. We have about 10 minutes left. I'd love to give you that time to talk about whatever you want to talk about, because you have a lot that you know about.
Well, one of the things I've just been working on a lot is, you know, a lot of people think there's no way plants could be intelligent because they don't have a brain. You know, it's like Larry Niven, the science fiction writer, once said, you know, how much intelligence does it take really to sneak up on a carrot, you know? And then we use these terms like, oh, he's a vegetable or things like that to refer to, you know, basically loss of brain function. Well, what's really interesting is the average human being has about 86 billion neurons in their brain, and we tend to think of the brain, you know, everybody's seen a picture of it, but what that really is an organ that has a set of neural fibers that run through it. And if you ever get on the internet and just type in to look at what the neural network looks like without the organ, like removed from it, what it looks like exactly is the root system of a plant. And it turns out that plants have a really sophisticated brain, and it's their root system, only they use the soil instead of an organ to hold that neural network. And there's a number of instances where the plants actually have a larger neural network than a human being, more than 86 billion neurons. So they're highly intelligent and highly adaptable, and there's a whole new field of work. A lot of people, younger scientists, are really tearing up the turf. They're completely humorous and are taking no prisoners, really, and basically are talking about the neural network of plants, and basically it's a field called plant neurobiology, and I think that's incredibly fascinating, and so I'm playing around with that a lot, and also the function of hallucinogens in the ecosystem, because plants and mushrooms that make those, it turns out that those hallucinogens actually stimulate neural network development and enhance the perception of and the adaptability of organisms that take it. So, you know, once again, I'm kind of in a leading edge sort of look at things here, which is kind of fun.
You know, that's kind of interesting that you talk about the roots and the neural network, because maybe about 10 years ago, I don't know if you know anything about me personally, but I had this spontaneous enlightenment thing, and with it came this really profound ability to dialogue with, I don't know, I call it source. I don't know what else to call it. And so I flew out there and spent several days with Roland McCready and his research partner. And when I sat down, that was the very first question they wanted to ask me about, was what would happen to plants if they did certain things to the roots. And one of the things that I can't remember what the question was, but one of the things I remember was, my answer was, if you do that to that plant, it will feel like you stuck the root into an electrical socket and electrocuted it. And so that's what they were researching, that very thing, but it got kind of put off the table to do all this other stuff that they're now working on. So it's just interesting.
Well, I think it also thought it was fascinating, too, because the person that first identified the location of the plant brain was Charles Darwin. And he wrote, his last book that he wrote was all about plants, The Power of Movement in Plants, I think it was called, and he talked about the location of the plant brain and the degree of intelligence. So I think it's hilarious that it's really the neo-Darwinists, the real reductive mechanicalists in the scientific community that get so upset when you talk about the plant having a sophisticated neural net and brain, and it was actually Darwin that was the first one that described it. So it's, you know, and this is just very interesting because for me, because it shows more and more and more how much everything in the environment is alive and everything's responsive, everything's aware, everything is changing and adapting all of the time. So the world we live in is more like what Buckminster Fuller said. He said we live in a scenario, not a place. You can get out of a place. You can't get out of a scenario. Everything's moving and changing and alive all of the time. And that's really what I enjoy working with and looking at how people can make deep relationship with plants and that intelligence. And that's basically what the native people said. That's what they would do. And then the plant itself would tell them its uses as medicine because the plant knows it better than any scientist ever will.
So that's my last question. How does someone know and experience plants? And how do they do it? And how do they recognize that they're doing it, if that makes sense?
Well, that's a lot of what my books are about, Sacred Plant Medicine, Lost Language of Plants, Secret Teachings of Plants, and Gaia's Mind. They all go into detail about that and the different steps and the stages. But really the simplest place to start is how does it feel? And it means you have to reclaim your feeling sense, which is something that Americans have been trained to not use. So the thing is, when you get to a plant, I just have people go and sit with the plants and then, you know, do some deep breathing and to get out of their head and just start paying attention to their body. So it's really easy. The first thing you do is you just then do that, and then you just look at the plant and you begin to minutely notice the color of its leaves and the shape, and you immerse yourself in sensory noticing of the plant. And when you're pretty deep in that, you just ask yourself, how does it feel? Just like that. And in that moment, when you say, how does it feel, there'll be what Goethe called, he said, there'll be this intimation of mood or feeling. You'll have this little burst of a unique feeling to the plant. And that's the thing that begins to lead you into the deeper awareness of how the plant works and what its medicine is and everything else. And there's a process involved in it that takes a while to figure out. But in the very beginning, I mean, I've worked with a lot of people that have never done anything with plants before, and doing these simple exercises, and then I'll have them say, well, write down everything that comes to you, every thought that you have, no matter how unrelated it seems. And so they'll just start writing down whatever images or thoughts or anything that happens. And I've done this hundreds of times in different cultures all around the world, and the people will come up with an absolutely sophisticated description of the medicinal qualities of the plant doing that. And then I'll just simply get out the book and read to them what the herbalist text says about it, and it's exactly what they've said, only theirs tends to be a lot richer and more detailed. So it comes down to trusting the response of the body, really.
We've got about 3 minutes left, and excuse me, I just wanted to remind or bring up the old book that you wrote about testosterone.
Uh-huh.
I think that's one of the greatest books that I bet I've referred it to 200 men.
That's great.
Is that still available?
Oh, surely it is. Yeah, and that started kind of because there's a particular herb that's particularly good for raising testosterone levels in men's bodies, and it's pine pollen, which has got the highest testosterone of any plant that I've ever found. It's extremely high in it. And it's one of the few herbs that, for some reason, never got discovered until, actually, I started writing about it, and a lot of people use it now.
Was it, but if I recall, it was a specific pine pollen. Did that change? Is it still Scott's pine pollen, or is it any pine pollen now?
Well, there's any pine pollen will do it. And when I first was writing about it, there hadn't been as much research, and Scott's pine was the one that I could find the most on. But I think in the new edition of the book, I think I've got 6 pines where they've analyzed the testosterone content of the pollen, and it's high in all of them. So pretty much any pine pollen can be used.
Any other little treats? We got about 2 more minutes that you want to share with anybody? That's a special treat, I think. The pine pollen.
What's a special treat?
Yeah, the pine pollen for the men. I mean,
it's
much better than getting
nice
a prescription
thing.
Of some pharmaceutical hormone and putting it on.
Yeah, it's great. And so I've heard from a lot of men around the world, and basically you have to take it as a tincture for it to work, because it needs to not go through the stomach. It needs to go through the bloodstream, into the bloodstream, which it'll do through the mucous membranes if you take it as a tincture. So the thing is, their testosterone counts will come up almost immediately. Their energy levels will increase. Their libido increases, and just their overall health and energy levels come up. So I started looking for something when I went into middle age, and there just wasn't much for men. And I was kind of tired of all of the books for women's hormone stuff, but there was nothing for men. So that sort of started me on this journey of figuring it out. And I pretty much am my own sort of laboratory. I figure out most everything in my own body one way or the other that way. And most of the herbs that I ever recommend to people, I usually take them in fairly large quantities so that I can find out what kind of side effects they might have if somebody takes a lot. So, you know, that's sort of one of my things that I end up simpling, it's called, actually.
All right, you want to tell us if we're going to have to wrap it up now one more time where people can find you and find all of your fabulous books?
Oh, sure. My books are all listed at Amazon.com, and my website is gaianstudies.org, G-A-I-A-N, studies.org, and they can find out probably more than they ever wanted to know about me right at that site.
And you have lots of information on not just about you on your website, too, that people would get great information from. I've just been all over it this afternoon, and it's just amazing. Oh, there's a Lyme protocol on there. So be sure and take a look at that if you have problems with Lyme, because he's got a great book on Lyme. So thank you, Stephen, for taking the time to come on my show. I'm grateful because you're always a wealth of knowledge, and I hope you'll come back sometime.
Yeah, you're welcome, Heva. It's great fun. Thanks for having me on.
Good night.
Night.